Hey friends, you're listening to the Madver Radio Podcast. We've had quite a layoff here. It's been about a month since the last episode's come out. We apologize greatly for that. Both myself and Matt have had a number of, life situations, you'd say, that have prevented us from being able to put any sort of time or effort into the show. So we apologize for that. We're going to try and get back on somewhat of a regular schedule. And we will try to do a better job of keeping everyone in the loop when it comes to the show release. One other bit of news. This will be the first show that comes out since we've started our t-shirt drive. We have a Mad Bro Radio t-shirt. Now, we had several options when getting the t-shirt made. We could have gone like a cafe press or one of those type services that would have taken care of a lot of the hard work for us. We chose not to do that because the quality of t-shirts that, like a cafe press, for example, nothing wrong with the company, but the quality was a bit lower on the t-shirts than what we would like the Madver Radio t-shirt to be like. So we've gone with a different supplier, but in order to do it, we have to order the shirts. And because we do run on such a low budget, we've decided to do it is, if you go to madverradio.com, click on the donate button, everyone between, I believe it was February 1st, everyone from February 1st to March 31st who donates $30 or more will receive a t-shirt. On the 31st, I will get in contact with you through the email that you provided to the PayPal and get address and sizes worked out with you. The dollar amount, the $30 amount, at that dollar amount, the show only keeps, I believe it's on average 35 cents. Okay. So we're not, it's not the public radio model. We're not charging you $100 for a $5 mug. That's the cost of the shirt, but it is a super high quality cotton t-shirt. It feels real soft. The shirt's, The sizing runs fairly consistent. Like, it's not one where you'll get a large and it's the same size as the medium or anything like that. We really like these shirts. It's our it's the little angry face logo. It takes up almost the entire front side of the t-shirt. They look really cool, really happy with them, and I know you'll enjoy them, and you get to show your support of the show. So that's the madbroradio.com. Click the donate button. Follow there, $30 or more between now and March 31st, and you will get a t-shirt. Now, if you're from outside of the U.S., please email madbroradio@gmail.com, and we can work that out with you. There's some extra shipping costs there, and but we'll have to go over some information on that. Oh, and I'm sorry, I forgot to say earlier, if you want more than one t-shirt, because we have had that question come up, due to the fact that we're only having to ship it once, it's $50 or more, and you can get a second t-shirt. And again, we only pocket like 35 cents off that. So that is it. Sorry for the long layoff. Check out the t-shirts. I will be including a picture of the t-shirt on our website when I make the blog post for it. And you'll be able to check that out at madbroradio.com. Thanks for listening to the show. I realize I've talked for like 5 minutes. I apologize for that. We'll get right into it. This is a great episode. It's with Carl Christensen from the Change Truth Podcast.
Head, grab a beer, go online, rock with me instead.
Hey friends, welcome to the Mad Bear Radio Podcast. See, don't laugh when I'm doing it. You're just going to break my flow. See, no, we're keeping this take now. We're keeping this take.
That's fine.
The Mad Bear Radio Podcast is done in one take. You're listening to that same podcast, the Mad Bear Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Davis. My co-host is Matthew Flowers, still laughing at the horrendous intro I just did. I want to thank all y'all for listening. You can find us on madbearradio.com. We're on iTunes. Just search us, YouTube, all that good stuff. Today we have a great guest. It's going to be a good show. We have Mr. Carl Christensen from the Change Truth Podcast. Welcome to the show, buddy.
Right on, man. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a bit about your show, what you're trying to do with Change Truth.
Sure, yeah. So like the podcast that I'm doing, I'm talking to people about drugs, addiction, and mental health. And I mean, the main focus for me is I'm talking about the illegal drugs and some of the potential that they have to be used medicinally, therapeutically, beneficially, when people are actually educated about how to do that. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to educate people about these things and the dangers. You can't really talk about drugs without also talking about addiction and mental health. They're all kind of connected. So, I mean, that's the gist of it, you know.
And where are you coming from here? As you have experience with this yourself, as I understand?
Yeah. Definitely. I've got experience with all three, from mental health, things like depression, anxiety, stuff like that I've battled through. And drugs, I've used some myself. I've had family members who have been addicted very much so to certain substances. And I've also been able to use things like mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, and marijuana to medicinal benefit for myself. So I can come from that perspective. And I've also had addictive tendencies myself, too, so I can understand addiction quite well, even though I haven't really had, like, the classic hardcore addiction to something like heroin or cocaine or something along those lines.
Okay, so you weren't, like, giving dudes blowjobs for weed, were you?
No, I never got to that level. No, I mean, my addiction, marijuana definitely is something that I've had addictive tendencies with in the past. I think it has that potential to be abused, you know, and that's something I have done through my college years. Definitely, I use marijuana that way, just very abusive.
Right on.
We spoke a little bit before and mentioned that I have been addicted to like video games too. I've found very addictive habitual behaviors with video games in my life, and that's taken up so much time and energy over my years that you can't call it anything but addiction, really. It's the same thing, and it comes down to the same thing, I think.
So that sort of broaches a really interesting topic, and that is when you talk addiction or anything in the realm of drugs, you sort of have to define what that word means. What does addiction mean when it can encompass heroin and video games and food?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
How do you do that? How do you define addiction?
Well, you know, someone I really like who's doing a lot of good work in the field of addiction these days, his name is Gabor Mate, and he's a physician out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. I'm in the Yukon, Canada, by the way, just FYI. I'm in Northern Canada. Addiction is like, it comes down to, I think, pain. Really, that's what Gabor Mate says, this guy, is that addiction is about trying to deal with pain in the life. Now, whether that's like a childhood trauma sort of thing, or it could be a number of things, right? But you have some kind of pain. Maybe it's like a broken relationship. Maybe you were abused as a child. Maybe, you know, something that you're not dealing. Maybe you just haven't accomplished what you want and you feel guilty or embarrassed about something, and you try to seek out comfort. And I find, like, personally, I become more willing to get into these addictive behaviors when I'm like really tired or if I've had a shitty week, you know, I'll come home and maybe that'll be the time I get into a video game and I play that for like 12 hours, or I just get stoned all day or something like that. And I think it comes down to just feeling shitty about whatever and then trying to cover that up, trying to fill that void with these outside substances.
Yeah, and sort of where I approach it is, it's no secret on this show, I'm a huge fan of the Dr. Drew and the Loveline show, and he has a very succinct definition of addiction. It is continued use in the face of consequences, which I think sort of encompasses what you're talking about there, right? If something brings consequences and you continue to use in spite of those, then that is addiction.
Right.
It sort of encompasses the same thing you're talking about there. So when we talk about sort of the, I guess, the air quotes soft addictions, the food, the video games and such, that they can have the same tendencies. I know me personally, it's something I dealt with. I played World of Warcraft for 10 years, like 10 years. And you know, they keep a little log in game. You can type /played. You can see all your in-game time, and it's something like 16% of my life over that 10-year period. It's like one out of every 8 moments. Just spin a clock. You know, if you have a twister wheel, right?
Yeah.
Every red space is going to be me playing WoW, and that is tremendous consequences from that. I mean, I have relationships, you know, there's lots of things fail in life in the same way as sort of the hard addictions do.
Sure.
I know you weren't necessarily as bad as I was with, because you were EverQuest peasant, but can you speak to sort of the consequence cycle that exists both in the soft and the hard addictions, the sort of more encapsulate what we're talking about here?
Because
anything can be addictive, right? Like people.
Totally. People are addicted to weird things. You can become like a sex addict, which is weird to me, but you know, for some people, that's where they get the rush or whatever.
See, like I know. I definitely myself, definitely Matthew, and I would assume you have had like the day where you just stay home and beat off like 10 times.
Like that's happened once or twice. Yeah, I think along the same days when I was playing EverQuest all day, that was kind of goes hand in hand
at the same time.
But speaking to like consequences, like a good example for me was like while I was playing EverQuest all the time, and EverQuest is this. I don't know if your audience would know that right away, but it's like World of Warcraft. This game you can just spend so long playing, you know, building up this character, becoming stronger. Anyway, and during that time, I also had other goals in life. My other goals were like become stronger in real life. In my life, I wanted to work out, build muscle. To do that, you got to go to the gym all the time, and you've got to eat healthy food. You got to get enough sleep and do all these things to build your own body up. But I would, despite having these goals, I would still spend all day on EverQuest. I would eat shitty food, like knowing good well I could go buy like some salmon and some rice, but instead I would just maybe order a pizza, play EverQuest, not get any sleeps, play till like 3 in the morning, get up whenever, not go to the gym. I would bypass all of these other things that would get me to where I do want to be. But I would bypass them because the rush of this game, that my need to be online in this game was so strong, things like that. And then, you know, plus grades in school and relationships as well and things like that. Yeah, it was just, yeah.
An interesting thing, I know with like me, my World of Warcraft playing was sort of self-medicating my own anxiety and depression problems, because you go into this world, you're not yourself, you're this super like buffed out avatar on the screen, and you make friends. I mean, I've been friends with people for like 9-10 years from this game, and I have way more of those friends than I had in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of this anxiety. It's easy to meet people online because if something goes wrong, you just ignore them forever.
Yeah,
you totally. Never have to interact again. So all this like anxiety problems that I have and had and have, all the depression issues, it was like self-medicating in the same vein, obviously on a different level, as someone who has the same problems, so they are shooting up.
Mm-hmm. I think it is very similar, yeah. It comes down to the same thing of, it was a really cool study they did recently, actually. I've read a bunch of articles referring to the same study, and they took rats, and I'm going to probably get like some of the things wrong here, but they basically took rats and they got them addicted to cocaine, and they got them addicted to cocaine while they were living in like this shitty cage that was like noisy. Have you heard of that study?
Yeah. I'm aware of this.
And tell me if I get something wrong. I forget. My memory is not serving me well, but they got them addicted to the thing.
So you want, go ahead.
They got them addicted to this thing in this cage that was like just a bad experience, right? And then when they took the rats out of that cage, put them in a good cage that things were, I don't know, comfortable for them, they didn't go to the cocaine anymore. It wasn't something that they needed anymore to feel good. They weren't trying to escape that shitty cage they were in. They were able to do whatever rats do to feel good without the cocaine, you know? And that kind of speaks to, I think, most people who become addicts are in a shitty situation in one way or another, you know? And it just, I think it's just different levels where a heroin addict may have been in the past or may still be in a really shitty situation that they're trying to forget or trying to pull themselves out of somehow. And so they turn to something very strong that's going to kill that pain. And a lot of these things that people get addicted to are really pain killers when it comes down to it. Like heroin, we use legally in hospitals, we just call it morphine, and it's a painkiller. You know,
how long did we use cocaine as an anesthetic?
Yeah,
for
cocaine as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just a big part of what I'm talking about is the fact that pretty much every single one of these drugs, all of the illegal drugs, I would say, have some kind of medicinal use potential. There's some way that they can be used medicinally. I mean, marijuana is an easy one. It's like a joke to even talk about anymore because clearly there's lots of things marijuana is being used for medicinally, but it's still illegal. It's just silly. And then even when you go into these other hardcore drugs, whatever it is, you know, like you can talk about cocaine and how cocaine is dangerous. And the way we use it now, this extracted form of cocaine. I was just recently in Peru. And in Peru, they chew the coca leaves for altitude sickness. Mm-hmm. And they just chew the leaves themselves that cocaine is extracted from. But when they use them in their natural state and use them and make teas out of them and things like that, it's much like having a cup of coffee or something, or even less than that. It's not a huge thing. You don't get addicted to that. And it can help medicinally with like altitude sickness in the mountains and certain things that give you some energy for the day, like a cup of coffee, you know.
Yeah, and you bring up sort of a interesting thing there when you talk about the Peruvians and the Bolivians and sort of the traditional use of of drugs,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I mean, every society known to man ever, aside from the Inuit, had a ritual use of drugs.
Hmm.
All of them. Whether it was ibogaine or alcohol or some drug had a ritual use in every society ever besides the people who didn't have plant life, right?
right. But I mean, is that true that Inuit didn't have anything that they were using?
That is my – okay, so I study crime. And I just off the top of my head recalling from one of my textbooks from a class I took on drugs and crime, that was something in there that the only society to exist that we don't have a record of them having a cultural use of mind-altering substances is the Inuit.
That actually makes sense. I was researching that not too long ago to try to figure out in my local area, because I'm from northern Canada, so there are Inuit population where I live. But I was looking into British Columbia and this whole area trying to find if anyone, specifically I was looking into psilocybin mushrooms to see if there was any traditional practice using that. And I couldn't find any with the mushrooms. And I couldn't find much with the Inuit either. There were a few cases, like not with the Inuit, but then the native people a little bit south, like in northern Alberta and like Saskatchewan, they used, I think they made a brew out of Amanita muscaria. Mushrooms, and same in like Siberia, some of the native people there would use that. I think you have to mix something with the Amanita to make it work properly, though.
Oh, there's some voodoo magic going on where they make it all cool. And what you have there is those were cultural practices, and what you were talking about with the coca leaves, we've completely removed that in our society today. Like, why aren't there hieroglyphs of or whatever the writing the Mayans had? Why don't the Mayans have writing about all these people who were like hooked on peyote or iboga or whatever? It's because we've completely removed that, and instead of chewing coca leaves, which we've decided to go from like 1% cocaine to we're putting 90% pure cocaine right up into our nostrils.
Yeah.
You know, like we've completely removed all sort of cultural, sort of spiritual guidance usage from our drugs. And it's caused societally so many different consequences, especially, I mean, there's entire industries around people who can't stop doing drugs.
It's true. Yeah, we've gone to the extreme with that stuff. And I mean, our drug is alcohol. That's our practice. But we use it in such a ridiculous way. You know, people get a lot. There's a lot of alcohol has a lot of downside because for a lot of alcohol is one of the only drugs that you just continuously take. I mean, you do that with cocaine as well, I guess. Some people continuously snort rails or whatever. But alcohol especially, you know, you don't really dose yourself very well. You're just like, I'm gonna have a couple beers, and someone buys you a shot, and then you go do another whatever, and by the end of the night you don't even know how much you had. And that's just our culture around it, is to go get drunk at a bar. It's like, not the best.
What part of your body doesn't feel terrible after drinking?
There's no part that does not feel terrible. My mind feels terrible. Just the next day is awful.
Head hurts. All your muscles kind of ache. You got to pee 100 times. You can't even have, like, real good bowel movements. Just everything hurts.
Yeah. I mean, alcohol, it gets a bad rap, and it's easy to sort of talk about alcohol negatively. But I also think, just like anything else, it can be good, too. I mean, there's a reason people like alcohol. I think alcohol can be very useful in like social situations, you know, something like you go on a first date with someone. Having a drink is just a great way to break some ice and to just loosen up. So, I mean, I don't think alcohol is inherently just evil. And a lot of like people like pot advocates like to really bash alcohol and just say it's terrible and should be illegal. But I mean, alcohol is just like any other drug. They're all the same. I think they're all the same. They can all be abused, or they can be reused responsibly for some kind of benefit, you know.
So tell us a bit about your experience in using psychedelics to sort of address abuse cycles with drugs that you've experienced, and then some of the work that you're doing to sort of promote that same effects.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, I was never really someone to do a lot of drugs, although I've always been super interested in them. I've talked to anyone who would be willing to talk about them since I was young, since I was really young. I was always afraid of all the sort of chemically altered substances, things like acid and MDMA. Because when I was young, I had heard the saying that everyone else heard, that, you know, I heard MDMA could like wreck your spine or something, and acid would like eat your brain, and like just it could make you go crazy. But the one thing I did try early was psilocybin mushrooms. And that really was, that and marijuana were really the only drugs that I did for most of my life. And I tried mushrooms early. I used them first when I was 14 years old with a group of friends in the forest.
Which sounds like a great situation.
Yeah, and that was definitely, like, that was the beginning of my initiation into how mushrooms work. But definitely at the beginning there, I wasn't using them to get any kind of, like, medicinal therapeutic benefit. That's something I've developed over a long time of practicing with them, is understanding that they can be used that way and they can be very effective that way. So they've helped me with depression specifically, and anxiety as well, which is kind of related to depression. But
tell me about that first time. You're 14 in a forest getting blasted in outer space. That sounds like the highest anxiety situation I can think of.
No, that was funny. It was a funny story. So I had a group of friends, like my core group of friends at that time, probably there's about five of us. And we'd already smoked pot and we'd already drank alcohol a few times.
Gateway drug.
And we had this little clearing in the forest near a beach in my hometown. I'm from this town called Tofino on Vancouver Island, small little beach town. And there's this forest, like, up the hill from the beach. It's a really beautiful area. We had this little clearing in there where there were some, like, big cedar trees that had fallen over. And we had this little sort of clearing that we smoked pot in a lot. So anyway, my friends, they call me one day and they're like, hey, we brought a bunch of mushrooms. We're going to do them. Do you want to do them with us? And I think they kind of thought, like, I was never really the person to be into, like, any kind of hardcore drugs at all. So they kind of expected me to say no. But I was like, no, you know what? I'd like to try that, actually. I've heard about that. I've heard mushrooms. I've heard about mushrooms a few times, and it sounded appealing. So we ended up going. I realized my friends had bought an enormous bag of mushrooms. Like, they had so many. I don't even know how many ounces.
How much do mushrooms cost?
They're cheap. I mean, gram for gram, they're cheaper than marijuana is. And where I'm from,
that means nothing to me. I don't know how much marijuana costs.
I don't know. If you wanted to get, like, so if you bought, like, an ounce of mushrooms, you might be looking at, like, I don't even know now, like, $100, $150 or something. Something like that.
And how many, like, trips is that?
Well, for one full dose of psilocybin mushrooms, generally is about 3.5 grams, and there's 28 grams in an ounce. So if you spend $100, you could trip by yourself like over 10 times or something.
You could live on Pluto for a month.
Yeah, you'd be just fine. So anyway, we get this huge bag of mushrooms. We go down to the forest, and I mean, we all mentioned part of the reason I wanted to do it, actually, this is kind of interesting, is my father was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was like 20 years old. He had a mental breakdown, was institutionalized, was in a mental hospital. And I kind of had this this feeling that maybe I might go crazy one day. I had this idea in my head, like, maybe I'm going to have that happen to me. And I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to get schizophrenia when I'm his age, and that's going to happen to me. And I was very curious about this for a long time. I mean, I knew pretty early that he had gone crazy. That was, you know, when I'm young, that's how I view it, right? He went crazy. And so I was kind of curious, and I had heard that drugs, these psychedelics, may cause that to happen. And so kind of, in a way, I was like,
it was the demon weed. That's what it did.
I was like, if I'm going to go crazy, I kind of want to feel what that feels like. So that was part of the reason why I wanted to try the mushrooms, I think. So I get a taste, like, maybe I'm going to go crazy. If I'm going to go crazy, why not go crazy now? You know, let's get it over with.
Wow.
So we went and did the mushrooms. One of us had done them before. The rest of us had never done anything like that. But I mean, overall, like, I don't remember all that much about that experience other than, like, the forest looked really cool. It was a beautiful sunny day. We all sort of just, there was a lot of laughing, like a lot of goofiness and silliness, but no one had any, like, bad time. Like, you know, everyone was totally fine. And I remember is going home afterward, after doing it and waiting for our pupils to go back to normal size so we could leave the forest. And I went back home to and my mom was in the kitchen, and I went up and said hi, and I just had this like mind-blowing experience. The sort of thing that I think you get when you first try a psychedelic drug is like, oh my God, my whole world can shift in this, in an instant. Like, all I have to do is eat a mushroom and my whole perception of the world is shifted. And it was really hard to like put into words at the time. I wanted to talk about it with someone, but I knew I couldn't really talk to my mom because she would either get mad at me, ground me, tell me I can't hang out with those kids anymore. She would be afraid for me, afraid that I might get addicted or something. Or so I knew I couldn't talk to my mom about it. And that was kind of that was challenging because I had to go home and just be silent about this thing that I had just experienced. And so I had to sort of research it on my own. I had no one to really turn to talk about these things. So I had to sort of get into that, what this meant and what that was. And I started researching that kind of stuff. And that's, I really got into it for a long time. That was my focus for a lot of years, was just figuring out what this meant. What was this? What was this other world that I was opened up to?
Yeah, and that same type of change is sort of the same story you hear from people who their first exposure is in treatment for like PTSD or any other sort of issue that they're trying to use psychedelics to help. You know, the people who take the trips down to wherever to do what's it called, ayahuasca.
Right, I had just done that actually. That's why I was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Wow.
So yes, yeah. Skip the mushrooms. Let's hear about
that. So hold on. question about ayahuasca: is there like an ayahuasca tour group?
Oh, I'm sure there is. Yeah, it's becoming pretty popular tourist attraction kind of
thing. Thanks, Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Joe Rogan. No doubt.
Guy makes brain pills, and then suddenly everyone's booking trips to Peru.
Well, yeah, him and Aubrey, I think, are the big influences on that.
His name's Chris.
I
don't understand. Okay, like he couldn't have been with like Jake. He had to go with a name that most people are gonna like. You see it written, looks like a girl's name.
Apparently, it's like his middle name or something. So it was already kind of his name.
Yeah, but like you're allowed to have a female middle name, right? Like,
well, you're allowed to have whatever name you want.
tell me about that experience. Was it this whole like visiting another consciousness and like you're vomiting and expelling your demons, and is it like the marketing says?
I would say yes and no. Like I had, you know what, like the ayahuasca experience, there's so much to tell. Like
how much did this cost? Like how do you,
a lot.
How do you arrange, like if I don't think I could just like book a flight to Lima? Damn it, why am I forgetting the capital? Yeah, Lima?
Yeah,
okay.
Lima.
I wanted to say La Paz, but that'd be Bolivia. If I just booked a flight to Lima, I wouldn't know like how to find the dude who can take me to the magical plant. Like
right. how do you wouldn't want to do it that way. You'd want to, I think, set it all up beforehand, which is what I did. I heard about ayahuasca through the Joe Rogan experience as well, through Aubrey talking about it. And I decided to go to the same place that he went to. So that's where I went. And it was expensive. Definitely wasn't cheap. But if you can afford it and you're into that kind of stuff, I would definitely recommend that place. It was a great place, great experience. And I mean, I also like I was working a seasonal job that had just ended. So I had some time. And so I chose to travel throughout Peru like for a couple weeks before the ayahuasca thing, just to sort of make a trip out of it. So I traveled throughout the country a bit and then went into the ayahuasca retreat.
Really? So I'm still focusing on this. Like, so like this is How do you get in contact with these people to set it up ahead of time?
Well, there's a lot. I mean,
you Google ayahuasca.
Yeah, you can Google. Yeah, there's lots of resources out there now because it's becoming so popular. Like, there's a website called ayaadvisor.org, which has like a one of those like Yelp or whatever, one of those rating sites where people like review different retreats and whatnot. And there's a lot of info out there now.
Better Business Bureau of psychedelics.
Yeah, so you can find it if you're looking. And I mean, I found mine, the place that I went to, through Aubrey, and he posted on his website where he went and the website of that place. And so I looked into it and researched it and just did it. Said, you know what, I'm going to fucking check this out for myself and see what it is. So,
right on. So what was your big takeaway from the ayahuasca journey?
I mean, when we went down there, we drank the stuff 4 different times. Like, it's an 8-day stay, and 4 separate nights you have an ayahuasca ceremony. So we did it 4 times, and not every experience for me was like mind-blowing at all. Actually, the first couple were like more mild than most of the times I've done mushrooms, really, and they were very comparable for me. It was similar. And actually, so I'll just tell you about the big experience that I had, the one that was like the most mind-blowing or whatnot. It was the third night, and I had a couple very mild experiences the first 2 times. I had asked to double the dose. So instead of drinking just 1 cup of the stuff, I drank 2 full cups of the stuff because I wanted to make sure before I left, I wanted to make sure I got to that point where I was like, you know, because I had heard so much about it and I had wanted to get to that level of, you know, what everyone says about it, like this is magical thing, right? So I went for this extreme dose, which was probably too much. Tastes pretty awful. So drinking 2 cups of the stuff is pretty gross. But so anyway, so for me, that was the most powerful experience. And what happened on that? So it's very colorful, the whole thing. You'll see there's like I was like inside a disco ball, which a lot of like colorful lights kind of circling around me. And it was interesting. I would have been more pleased with it, except that my stomach was also very nauseous. So I was kind of like fighting off the urge to throw up for a while. And then I did throw up. And then after like half an hour after that, it was still, I was still just like hard to focus because I was nauseous. And I was still okay. I felt fine, except I was just kind of like fighting that off. And then all the colors were very distracting, I found. And then, so what happened then though, in the peak of this colorful light show and nauseous stomach, there were 3 beings of some, now you can call them like spirits or elves or aliens or whatever. They were
Mormons.
There were 3 skinny, short, in all white light, these entities that were right above my head, to the left and above my head, and I could feel them doing something to my mind. I could feel this clear sensation that they were fiddling around with something in my head. And not only that, but I could feel that they were good intention, that I did not have to fear them. I had this clear sensation that these things, whatever they were there for my benefit. I should not be alarmed. Just let them do whatever they're going to do. So I was like, okay. And before you do this stuff, you kind of like the shaman there, the sort of leader, they talk about this, like whatever happens, just the best thing you can do is just let it happen. Don't be afraid. Don't worry. Don't try to fight it. Just go with it. It's going to be fine. So that's what I did. I was like, okay, it's cool. Let it happen. And now the most interesting part about that is that afterward, I talked to a few other people at the retreat, and they described the exact same beings in their experience the previous night and the next night. Like, other people there had described the exact same things, doing the exact same thing to them. Sort of, they could feel a buzzing in their head. They could feel them sort of tinkering with something. And so that was like the most profound, most interesting part, I think, of the whole experience for me.
Really? So it's like it's a communal experience. I think that has to sort of heighten it, knowing that it's not just some silly popping stuff going on in your head. It's a communal aspect.
It made it very interesting for me because I've never experienced anything like that. Something that was like completely shared, because like I was describing it to this other guy, an Irish guy who was down there. And I was like, oh, yeah, I saw these things last night. We were at breakfast in the morning. The next day, I was like, yeah, these entities were like just sort of messing with my head somehow. And they were like these kind of weird. And he was like, oh, they were really short, right? And there were three of them. And I was like, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Were they all white? And I was like, yeah, they were white. And they had like skinny heads and they were only, you know. And he just described them the exact same way. Like, it was clear we both had the exact same experience with these things on different nights, not even on the same night. So, and the shamans, what the shamans say is that these are the plant spirits. That's what they say. They're the plant spirits. Then when they're singing, during the ceremony, the shaman sings songs. And what they say that they're doing is calling in the spirits of the plants to help heal the people in the room. And that's what they say. And I'll just throw out there now that, like, I'm still on the fence about the whole shamanism thing and like the whole aspect, the whole traditional thing.
What do you mean?
Like, I think the shamanism thing is one way to do this stuff, but I don't think it's the only way. I don't think that their traditional
define routine. Shamanism.
Right. So like, it's a whole process. Like, it's very different than what we're used to.
So the whole like ritualized aspect there, you know, singing a song specific way. You gotta, you know, step two times with your left foot, and then
it's very much like that. Like, they bless, like, so at the beginning of the ceremony. So first of all, there was a big group too that I went with. There was like 25 people, which was like too many. I mean, personally, I think there was too many, but they made it work, and it was okay. So we had 25 people in this big, huge hut. They call it a maloka. And the shaman, they begin by blessing everyone. Now, they do this with this native Peruvian tobacco. They call it mapacho. It's a big cigar of tobacco. And so the shaman goes over every single person and sings. He like whistles a song that's about 3 minutes long. It's like a full song. And he hits people on the head with this bundle of leaves. I forget what they call it. And that's kind of his beat. And it's like it's very fast paced, and he blows tobacco smoke on every single person. He does this for everyone, and we do that before anyone even drinks the stuff. Everyone gets blessed that way, and then he blesses the entire hut with tobacco smoke. And it was this whole process. I mean, the whole blessings pre ceremony thing took like an hour or so. It took a long time. So you're sort of just sitting there, waiting for everyone to be blessed and for the whole area to be blessed. And so there's a lot of that kind of stuff, a lot of this ritualized ceremonial stuff that they believe is completely necessary. They think they're protecting everyone in the group from evil spirits and whatnot, because what they say is that when you take something like ayahuasca, you become very susceptible to energies or whatever. So they're saying, like, if there's evil energies around you, you could take those in more easily. So they're protecting you from those entities. That's what they say. And I don't know if I believe that 100%. I'm on the fence. Like, I don't know.
Believe it can be done. Yeah. I want to be able to roll into McDonald's and get myself some Amanita mascara.
Yeah. I just think there's other ways to do it. I don't think their way is the only way. That's what I would say.
So while this whole thing is going on with all these other people, on the times where you didn't have the strongest experiences, so you're all in the same hut, right?
Yeah.
So you can watch other people that may be having a much stronger experience.
How much banging's going on in this hut?
Zero. There's a zero sex policy the entire 8 days. And there's a whole diet. Like, you have to abstain from a bunch of different things. You can't eat pork. You can't eat salt. There's a few different things. And sex is on the list. You can't see anybody. It's completely dark. They do it at the ceremony at nighttime, and they turn off. They have a few candles that they keep lit well, like at the beginning, but then within like an hour, they blow out all the candles. And so you're in complete darkness. You can't see anyone, but you can hear them. You can hear them puking into their buckets, because that's pretty common. Like, that happens a lot. So there's like a whole chorus of that.
What do they do with all the vomit?
You have little buckets. They clean up the next day or later that night. Yeah.
You don't know where the bucket goes.
No.
So it must be pretty big that you all have your own space to where people aren't bumping into each other or anything like that. So are you just sitting the whole time? You're just kind of sitting there? Or?
Yeah, you had a choice. You could either take a mat, like a large yoga mat kind of thing, or you could sit in like a rocking chair. I sat in the mat. Most people use the mat. So we're pretty much, most of us are on mats. And like I said, it was a huge group. There's like 25 people, which was, it was tight. Like there was not that much extra space. And it is kind of just like when you have that many people and like they had like a code word. So the only thing you're allowed to say during ceremony is baño. And baño is bathroom in Spanish. Because not only do you throw up often, but often people have diarrhea, or not even just diarrhea, but like they just have to poo when they are on ayahuasca. So you say baño, you put your hand up, and then some of the helpers, there's a bunch of helpers that are like sort of waiting along the wall or something. They have little tiny flashlights that they go around, and they'll help anyone who has to use the washroom back to their room. To use the washroom and then bring them back when they're done. And when you have 25 people and people are throwing up and people are saying baño and people are walking around, it's pretty distracting. And so that was one of the sort of things that I wasn't a big fan of, was how many people that were there. Cause it's hard. You kind of want to be able to concentrate when you're under the influence of something like that. You do want to be able to sort of focus your thoughts. So that was a little distracting, I would say.
Did anybody else like lose their cool? Were anybody like does anybody freaking out around you? I mean, because I could see how that could negatively affect something like that as well.
You know what? During the actual ceremony, I didn't encounter any of that. I think there were some people who said that they were freaking out, but I think a lot of them they were freaking out on the inside. So. You couldn't see, and nobody around me was doing that. There was the one guy said that on his first night, he was like crawling around. He was like totally tripping out, like he didn't know what was going on. And he was like trying to, he kind of found himself off of his mat and then just got like totally confused. It's pitch black. He doesn't know where he is. And he's like, he said he spent like an hour just like trying to crawl back to his mat and find his bucket and like didn't know. So, that could happen, but it wasn't like I didn't notice any of that. Pretty much everyone just laid still and you know, somewhat still or sat still. Yeah.
Wow, this sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
You know what? Like, what I got out of it, like the alien thing I bring up, just because I think that was a really cool fucking thing that happened to have a shared experience like that. That I felt it and I experienced it, so I know that that was real. Like, I know when you think about these things, people think about hallucinations and you hallucinate, but I've never, ever hallucinated anything. Taking mushrooms for as long as I have, I've never felt the presence of a fucking entity like something that I could tell was there, like was definitely there. And well, you're
just not going to church enough.
Well, maybe. what was I going to say? What I got out of the whole thing, with ayahuasca, what I took away from it most was that I shouldn't fear anything. For me, that was what I came away with. During that high, like after the sort of entities were doing their thing to my head there, after they left, my stomach calmed down eventually and the colorful visions stopped being as intense. And for a while, I just... I sort of kept getting this message in different ways, in different thoughts, just giving me this message that like I shouldn't be so afraid of what all the stuff that I'm afraid of. There's no reason to be afraid. All this anxiety people have in their lives and that I have in my life is just like it's our own construct. And you really have nothing to fear, and you should just go create whatever you want to create, do whatever you want to do. Don't be afraid to just put yourself out there. Don't worry about what people are going to think. And that for me was the biggest thing I got leaving that the whole ayahuasca thing, was that I should not be afraid to do what I want to do. And that really helped me. And that was actually kind of what I needed. It wasn't what I was looking for specifically when I went there, but it definitely was a good thing to take away from that.
So it was still positive, even if it wasn't as big of a of a deal as a lot of people have said it is, you know, every single night having these crazy intense experiences. At least it was still beneficial.
Oh yeah, I definitely felt like it was beneficial in that. Yeah, for that third experience, I got like the full thing. But yeah, for me, like the first couple nights were definitely a bit of a letdown, because I like I had listened to Aubrey Marcus tell his stories, and I had researched ayahuasca over and over and heard all these people say how mind-blowing it was and just how people would relive their past traumas in their life and all of this stuff. So I was really kind of expecting that to happen. Like I was going in there thinking, okay, I'm going to relive some shit from when I was 6 years old and my father and mother were fighting, or like I want to get into some of this shit. And it just that never came up for me. I never went into any past stuff like that. But that being said, like there were a lot of people there who did, because after every ceremony, every night that we took ayahuasca, the next day we'd have like a sharing circle where we'd pass a talking sticker around and everyone would get to share their own experience and what they felt and how that, you know, how it affected them. And, you know, so I heard a lot of other people's stories that were very profound in that sense. Like the clearest example from other people is was a soldier who was in Iraq for years, and he came home and he had post-traumatic stress syndrome, like without a doubt. He was like, he would talk about, he had two young children and a wife, and he came back to them and he couldn't relax. And he was afraid for them at all times. He had bags packed in his house so they could leave at any moment, just in case like whatever went down, like the war came home, you know. And he was in that war mindset that, and he had guns all over and just was, he couldn't fucking relax. And it was really stressing him. It was bad. That's the best I can explain post-traumatic stress syndrome, but he definitely had that. And for him, he had the most roughest experience of anyone on the very first night we drank this stuff. It was bad. Like during the thing, I didn't notice if he made a commotion or anything, but the next day, everyone else, like the ceremony goes from like 9 p.m. to like 2 in the morning. And the next day we all sort of got up by like 10 a.m. and he was still throwing up in the morning and dry heaving. And he had been throwing up all night, like from 10 p.m. till 10 a.m. the next day. He was still throwing up, still having these purging, as they call it. This
heck, I know that'll party.
And yeah, I mean, for him, he had a really rough time with it. He didn't drink the second time. He passed on it. He became so dehydrated. I don't remember if they gave him an IV or what, but it took him a while to recover. But the funny thing was, when he recovered, what he said was like, that was totally what I needed. And the whole time I was throwing up, I was like just reliving all of these traumatic events from the war, from being in Iraq, and these things that he had seen. And he had to let go. He had to let go of all this shit that he was stressing out about and holding on to and feeling guilty about. And so, I mean, that was a very powerful example of the power of these substances, because it worked for him. It helped him a lot. And by the end of the thing, he was very adamant about how much it did help him.
Awesome. It's good to hear that, like, you know, we send people over there, like, as a taxpayer, like, when soldiers are sent anywhere, it's on my behalf, or not so much as a taxpayer, it's like a voter, as a citizen, they're there on my behalf.
And yeah.
Like, when they're injured or when they die, that's because I put them there. So this idea that someone was, like, suffering as a result,
I think a lot of them, when they come back, are suffering.
They are suffering because of what I put them through, and the idea that there is an avenue in which they can find some sort of relief, and we'll throw your ass in prison for that.
Yeah, exactly, and that's one of the biggest fields of study that they're doing these days. To promote these beneficial effects of these psychedelics is they're doing with soldiers, they're doing therapy with usually it's MDMA. That's the big one they're using these days. But they're also talking about people have used ibogaine or ayahuasca or psilocybin to a very similar effect to just help people get over the shit. Because I think we don't really realize what it's like to go to war. Like, when you're over there and you're getting orders, you're being ordered, like, and you're trained for so long to just follow your orders because that's in the best interest for everyone. And then you have to, like, say you have to shoot a kid. Say a kid picks up a rocket launcher.
Yeah, the Chris Kyle deal.
Right. Yeah, I don't know too much about that, so don't grill me on that one.
Oh yeah, that's the scene from a movie that everyone replays.
Yeah, the American Sniper, right?
It's real flowery. I'm not sure I'm not sure if that's one of those things that actually happened, but Clint Eastwood makes a great movie, and that's a good thing. That'd be really traumatic if that actually happened.
Yeah, and it's just an example. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know too much about the drama behind his book and all that stuff, but
it boils down to that Chris Kyle was a bad person, and
yeah,
he after he got back, he decided to do some good things, but it didn't change the fact that he was a terrible person. Sorry.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Well, if you say so, I don't know. But I mean, I think it's just hard for the soldiers.
Listeners, if you disagree, I will fight you. Chris Kyle was a psychopath. He joined the military effectively as a mercenary. Whatever. Okay.
Not to derail. Some hate on that.
Oh yeah, hate all day. Chris Kyle was a bad person. Any time you kill 180 people, and your answer is to do my job.
That's like a lot of people. Did he really kill 180 people?
Yeah, it's like 180 confirmed kills.
Right. Wow.
And
that would be tough.
Don't regret a single one. Just doing my job.
Well, it's hard to. I don't have a lot of, like, obviously, I don't blame the soldiers. I don't have a lot of hate for soldiers. I don't have really hate for anyone. Even the people sending them over there. It's like, so many people are just caught up in a lot of bullshit. I don't know. I don't want to get it too political, but I think with the soldiers, it's hard because you go over there and you're in this situation, and in that situation, you have to be a killer. Like, you have to be on your game. You can't be fucking around. You have to take out these targets because they might take you out, and whatever you're being told, kill whatever. So you look down the sights of a gun and you see someone's face, and then you shoot them, and you remember their face, and you remember what they look like, and then you come back to North America, to wherever you live, and you have to remember that.
Shopping and
yeah, and you got to live around all these stupid people who are into Kim Kardashian and fucking whatever. Don't tell me you're into Kim Kardashian.
Let's not rag on Kimmy, okay? Like, there are some things that are sacred. Okay?
Yeah, no, it's just an example. I don't hate Kim either. She's doing her thing.
And it's Kim West, okay?
Is that right?
Kim West.
Right.
No, but see, with Chris Kyle, my issue is that when there should be some regret, there should be some. If you can kill someone and have no sort of negative feelings about killing someone, there's a problem there. And I realize we put you in that situation. Like, again, like I was saying, as a citizen, Chris Kyle was there on my behalf.
That's true.
But it doesn't sort of change the fact that he killed 180 people and talked about how he had no remorse, and then wrote in his book that during Katrina he was sitting on top of the Superdome taking shots at looters.
Well, we're hearing that.
He didn't really, though. So at least that part, you can't really hold that against him. He didn't kill any looters.
Oh. I had heard that, too. Maybe Joe Rogan mentioned that or something.
Yeah, that's on a podcast, yeah.
That wasn't in his book. That was in another soldier who he told the story to, reported that in their book. But he talked about taking shots at looters. It's like, I have a problem when killing people becomes something you joke about.
Well, he didn't really do that, though.
Listeners, if you want to fight me on Chris Kyle, I can fight you.
Man. Somebody's going to edit just those clips into a 3-minute YouTube video.
Oh,
Terrible person.
Imagine the publicity we would get. Like, how many followers did Michael Moore get from saying something not really against Chris Kyle? He made a generally true statement. Like when did snipers suddenly become, like, okay? Like, hell, I remember when, like, snipers were, like, cowards.
What? When was that even a thing? You're bullshitting now.
No, it was really the Vietnam era people. Like, snipers were the bad guys. They were cowards.
Not if they were on your team. Fighting.
See,
there was no guy that came back home and was like, yeah, I had a terrible time. I had to fucking share a bunk room with this sniper. You know how they're assholes.
Yeah, you know what they came back with saying? Yeah, we were just walking there. I was eating my MRE, and suddenly my best friend took a bullet through his head, and I couldn't tell where it came from.
From the other snipers, not their snipers.
I'm saying that, like, Michael Moore made a tweet basically making that point, that, like, snipers used to be the bad guy. And now, because Chris Kyle did it...
They still weren't the bad guy. American snipers have never been considered the bad guy by the American people.
I don't think so.
I don't think there's ever been a time where you came snipers home ashamed that you were a sniper.
Snipers in general. In the abstract, snipers.
Well, of course you don't like snipers from the other team. They're fucking shooting you.
Yeah, but it's... Okay, so, like, if you're looking into, like, the ethic of combat, okay...
The only people that look into the ethics of combat are the people that are looking to bitch about Chris Kyle.
No. Like, people have written books about this. The Art of War. Hell. Dude, Sun Tzu.
Page 69 in The Art of War. Fuck snipers.
I think the original Art of War was, like, just one long page.
A scroll.
Yeah. The Chinese had scrolls, right?
Is it Chinese?
Sun Tzu, yeah. The Art of War.
Oh. Anyway.
What you said about Chris Kyle, I don't believe that. I mean, I don't know anything about him, obviously. I haven't read his book or seen the movie or anything, but I find it really hard to believe that someone could do that and then not feel guilty. Like,
yeah, he said
on some level times, he must have.
He was like, nah, I don't feel guilty at all. Do my job. He said something about I'll show up at the gates and answer for every shot I took.
Yeah, well, I mean, just because people say something like that doesn't mean that's what they feel, though. Like, but I think that would be, and like, because that's, I don't know. Unless you, I guess there's a few ways that could happen. Is if either you're like a sociopath, that's what they call it, right? When you don't feel mm-hmm. empathy, or it's like you just believe so much in the greater good that you're doing, like you really believe in the American war machine, or you know, you believe in what you're doing, you believe in your orders, you believe in the government behind you, and then maybe you don't feel remorse because you believe it is for a greater good,
which is just as bad. Like, if one of the things we shouldn't give true believers a path just because you're a true, there were plenty of people in the killing fields in Cambodia who were true believers. They shouldn't get a pass. Okay.
What do you mean by true believers?
Like what you're saying, like I believe the mission here is just, and this is the right thing to be doing. Ooh rah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Just because you believe in what you're doing here, you shouldn't get a free pass just for that.
No, but it just might make him not feel that guilt. Like, because I would just find it so hard, like, to believe that someone could do that.
Still think he's a bad person.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I like to look at everyone with sympathy. I mean, if he did that and if he got tricked, maybe he did believe that everything he was doing was for a good cause, and I feel bad for him that he could do that and then not feel guilty, and because that sucks. Like, that sucks to be that guy if that is the case, you know.
And he obviously had issues with PTSD, and he did a lot of really good work when he got back trying to help other soldiers who were dealing with the same problems he was. Like, Bruce Kyle got back, like, good dude.
So if he did but if his, he had PTSD, then that's guilt. Like, I think a lot of PTSD is guilt. That's what it comes down to, I think.
Then you get into the whole deal with concussive brain injuries. You know, one of the things with what is it called? Breacher syndrome. It's the same thing with.
I haven't heard of it.
With the people who like they're the closest person to you know when like they're doing a raid and they have to like blow out this wall. There's okay. The guy who has to go run up and stick the explosives on the wall.
Right.
Oh.
It's usually the closest one to the wall when it goes off. Well, there's studies of those dudes who who they're the closest one. They get like concussive injuries to the brain from those explosions. Okay, it's like getting a lot of micro concussions in your head over and over and over again. And I was reading that they're seeing the same thing, and it's I think it's called Breacher syndrome. It looks a lot like PTSD, but it's not, because it's an actual it's because of actual injuries to the brain. And one of the things that they were saying is it's possible that snipers, people who have the you know, because those guns are really loud.
They get
lots of those real concussive blows, like the shoulder and neck area, that can cause the same sort of concussive rattling of the brain.
Right. So partly actual physical effects of what's happened to them.
Yeah, and I know that was still in theory, that hadn't been proven yet, but that's just my NPR knowledge of the subject.
Right. So, that makes sense. I've heard about weird shit happening to people who have concussions. I mean, even people who get concussions just playing soccer or playing a sport or whatever.
Yeah, like, think about how like the word concussion incorporates so many things. Like I'm sure Troy Aikman got a concussion in the middle of a game and went out there and still threw 300 yards. Okay. But then you have baseball players. What was the guy's name played for the Twins? Justin Morneau?
It's me.
No. Yeah, there was a baseball player. The first concussion of his life, and it ended his career.
Really?
One concussion. Okay, just career over. And then you know we have football players who get like four or five concussions in a game. And they're still out there just doing crazy things because
football players,
humans throwing their bones at other humans.
Mm-hmm. I think football players and UFC fighters have a real tough gig because they have to take so much physical damage that really, I mean, you just worry about their long-term health.
Well, the rule is boxers, because there's only like one or two dudes who are getting paid to actually get hit that many times.
You get paid enough, you mean?
Getting paid hardly at all. Like there's not that many people who are like making a good living when their job description is I get punched in the face.
Yeah, I mean UFC too. They don't pay the UFC fighters that much unless they're like the most famous of the famous.
Yeah. Even the low card guys, like their minimum is like what you're making well into your career in boxing. Yeah, this is it's a completely.
Is that right?
Yeah. Like I think it's like 6,000 to show, 6,000 to win, and if you're making
something like that,
if you're making a grand to show, a grand to win in boxing, like you.
Oh, is that right?
You might be headlining, you know.
Really? Jesus. Yeah. That's terrible. I didn't know that.
Yeah, boxing payouts are terrible now. Like if you're on a pay-per-view, so like if Mayweather fights whoever, like the lowest guy there might get $10,000, but there's gonna be four fights on a card, so we're talking about eight people, and the top two guys make all the money. The rest of those dudes are only making a couple grand, but there's just all the money just goes to so few people in boxing when their job title is getting hit in the head.
It's kind of like a metaphor for the greater society, really. It's like the people at the top make really killer money and have a really great life, and the people at the bottom don't make shit, and they have a terrible time, you know?
Yeah, and the people at the top, I mean, Floyd Mayweather gets paid all that much money because his gimmick is that he doesn't get hit in the face.
Yeah, it's a good gimmick. If you're going to have one, that's the one to have.
We've sort of strayed from the past. We have a normal recurring segment that we haven't done in the last couple episodes. We're going to get back to it. Excuse me. I just spoiled the own thing by recycling a phrase. Well, let's go back to the podcast, Kate.
Have we... Matthew. Oh, go ahead.
No, what was your question?
Go for it. Let's do it.
Oh, yeah, we're going back to the podcast. Matthew, what have you been watching on Netflix?
I don't think I've been watching much of anything.
Really?
I don't think I've even turned on the Netflix.
Well, this is upsetting.
Ruining the segment. See, I know.
It's so unprofessional. You text me all day about, dude, get off my dick. I'm a professional. I know what I'm doing. And then you're just not even.
I'm sorry. I didn't know watching Netflix is. I watched that documentary.
Which one?
The Central Park Five.
Oh,
it's a good really? Documentary. Yeah.
You know they all did it, right?
No, they didn't.
I mean, just look at them.
Right. Funny.
Okay. So, are you going to say words? Are you going to participate?
It was good. No, watch it on Netflix. That's what I've got to say. I don't
What is that? I've never even heard of that.
It's about
Central Park Five. Five boys were accused of, was it a rape and murder?
Rape and murder.
Yeah, a rape and murder of a white woman.
In Central Park.
In Central Park, New York City. Hmm. And, they had, like, no connection to it. It's just they just went and picked out five black
people. They happened to just be in Central Park at another time that same night, so.
Oh, so they got him. Wrongly accused?
Wrongly accused and
convicted.
Convicted of it and forced into confession.
What?
Yeah. Oh my god. It's so fucking nuts. You should watch it, definitely. I mean, it's maybe 2 hours, I think. It was.
So did they ever, like, are they still in prison, or what's the deal?
A guy confessed, spoiler alert, a guy confessed to it after they already served their time.
After they had served their time.
Yeah.
They actually got out? That's impressive.
Yeah, they were all 13, 14 years old at the time. Oh. Yeah, so I think they only did. I think the longest one of them was in there for was maybe 8 years or something.
Okay, man, that still sucks though.
I don't know what your wrongful conviction history is there in Canada, but like we can talk all day
about what's that
happening in America.
Well, I can talk about wrongful convictions for all these drug laws that are fucking bullshit and people shouldn't be in jail for, but. That's not exactly up the same lines.
Let's talk about. So, vast majority of people who are serving time for a drug related offense are people who. So if I get pulled over tomorrow with, what's a nominal amount of pot?
Nominal, like something that would get you in trouble.
No, what?
Let's say you had.
What's my daily use amount?
You've got 3 grams on you.
Okay.
Right.
I don't know.
In this hypothetical situation.
Okay. I'm gonna get inconvenienced, but they're not really gonna ruin. I'm not going to prison for it. Right.
Sure.
So there are. I mean, anyone with a Google connection. Can sort of look up, like, what are the regulations in your area? And you play that by your level of risk you're willing to accept.
There shouldn't be any. But I think the argument here is there shouldn't be. For some things, there shouldn't be
a risk. I'm saying in the interim, there is a choice aspect to crime.
Well,
And if you're unwilling to follow, at least if you're not willing to like do risk reduction, then you're sort of inviting some of that. Like,
okay,
you're
but if you but, okay risk reduction, then if we're saying that, so your answer to people being getting in trouble for having 3 grams of pot is they shouldn't have 3 grams of pot.
No, my answer is that it's better they have 3 grams than 30. In a risk reduction standpoint, like I don't know what the limits are. I don't carry pot around, so. But I think it's a lot of things where it should be legal, but in the interim, right now it's not.
3 grams is still going to be a bad time for you, in a lot.
Yeah, your day's going to get inconvenienced.
No, it's like, not going to be like, oh, I'm going to be late for work. I mean, it's
yeah, no,
no, no. I mean, it's like a DUI. It's like a DUI.
You live in Texas? I mean, yes. If you live in Texas, isn't it pretty damn strict on even marijuana down there?
Yeah, it's like getting a DUI. Like you your days.
That's pretty serious business. Getting a DUI.
That DUIs fucking suck.
Actually, because
I mean, you can't travel.
They'll take your license away and everything. So it's not as bad as a DUI. But I was saying, like, in terms of like the impact on your day to day,
you're not going to go into jail. But like the thing that I'll bring up is, I mean, in the U.S., it would be you'd probably. In your prison systems in the U.S., there are way more Hispanic and Black people in the prison for just overall, but also for drug-related offenses.
Whoa.
And then in Canada, it's the Native population. The Native population in Canada outnumbers everyone else in the prison system, and that really points to an imbalance in our society, not just the specific laws, but.
So I know here in America, white people are a majority of our prison population. You're saying that the natives are a majority of yours?
I don't know if they're complete majority. In places that do have a native population, they tend to be, majority.
And Matt looked real inquisitive when I made that statement. That should be entirely intuitive. A majority of the people in the country are white. Thus, they make up a majority of our prison population. Now,
Black people make up per capita percentage.
Yeah. So like Black people make up 10% of our national population, yet 30% of our prison population.
Yeah, right.
That's what that disparity is. And there are a lot of reasons for that. We have a lot of incapacitation sentencing for crimes that are committed more by poor minority groups, such as the disparity between crack and powdered cocaine. One's used a lot more by Black people, and the penalty's that much higher. Well, they stack up more. If you're giving a bunch of people 30-year sentences, it's going to stack up. You're not releasing them.
Right. So you're saying that the laws specifically target the things that they do that like is more common for that group of people to do. They get punished harder than the law. Like,
yeah.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Absolutely. I'm almost positive. I'm the only one who's going to know this. So this is rhetorical. I'm going to edit that. The first drug law in America was an El Paso City ordinance. Okay. It said that the Mexican immigrants couldn't use marijuana.
Yeah, right.
Why? Okay. Why? Of all the frivolous things.
Because it was. It's actually. If get yourself in the mindset and you'll realize, like, it's actually kind of a smart idea.
Okay, give me a second here.
You're a white guy who runs a farm in El Paso, okay?
Okay.
You control the government in El Paso because it's like 1880 or 1910 or whenever. You see there's these Mexican immigrants who are coming in working your farm. You see that they're taking this communal time in which they smoke this they smoke the hemp plant whatever. The marijuana is a Mexican slang term. And you see that communal time as they might be thinking about starting one of those unions like they have up north.
So the thought process was they're not going to hang out unless they can get stoned together?
Yes.
I don't really know that was that smart.
No. It's incredibly smart. If you're the best way to prevent worker revolt or worker collective or anything that would be worker feedback towards an employer is a community. And realize this is Texas and people who were alive during slavery. And what were the successful slave revolts? It was It was all groups of tightly bound groups of slaves who developed a community and were able to operate together in a cohesive unit. That's the mindset.
So, right. So they're trying to break that up.
Yeah. And one of the ways they did that was to make marijuana illegal now. It gives you an easy way of the groups who still do it. You can go in there, arrest the people who you see as the leader under the guise of law, and you have this protection here. And it all sort of spread. Anslinger, who was sort of the figurehead, he worked at the RAND, the Bureau of Prohibition. So the number one reason for outlawing drugs was because of their adverse effect on the degenerate races. Okay. There's a huge history of racism of affecting drug laws in this country.
Yeah, with marijuana specifically, I remember learning about that and from a few documentaries and whatnot that pointed that out, like the whole reefer madness sort of stuff. And earlier than that, it was often to Mexicans and blacks, they would say that they were the ones. Yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out about the prison populations. I'm not sure if it's like per capita percentile, there's more of them, or like, I'm not sure, but I know that they're overrepresented basically in the prison system.
And one of the interesting, you see minority overrepresentation in every country.
Yeah.
Which is,
and that should tell you something about the system, right? The system clearly benefits those who are in power, and the minorities don't have the power or the economic means. That's something I just did a podcast with another guy who runs a food bank up here, and he was talking about, we had a little chat about that, just the idea that the people who have the maybe the financial means or just the influence to get out of prison or to not even go to prison, they're the people
minority power, people who could pay to get out of prison.
Yeah, if you're a minority who's poor and doesn't have the ties to – you don't know anyone in the police force and you don't know anyone in that group, you're going to have a much smaller chance of not going to jail. Or if you can't afford a good lawyer, you can't afford any lawyer or these sort of things, you're going to be way more likely to end up getting harsher penalties than someone who – especially in a small community like where I live – in Whitehorse, people know, like everyone kind of knows everyone up here. So if you know people in the justice system or you know people in the police force or whatever, and you're in that group, and it's something you don't really think about when you're like privileged, call it like white privilege, right? Like you're just, you just take it for granted that you have these, that you can get out of stuff. Cause my mom's sewing buddy is the husband of the police captain. So he remembered me and he kind of gave me a slap on the wrist and let me go kind of thing. Whereas if you're maybe you're a native kid who's grew up on the reserve and there's a lot of fighting and bullshit that goes on there. And the police captain, he remembers seeing you when he had to go break up domestic violence and all this BS or whatever is going on, then he might be more willing to give you a, be like, you know what, I need to set this kid straight. I need to make an example. I'm going to give him a harsher penalty so he doesn't end up like his parents or whatever. Like there's just scenarios that come up that when you're a minority or when you're a poor person, not even just a minority, but just being a poor person, you're more likely to run into way more trouble with the law in our setup.
The whole situation there creates sort of a feedback loop in which people, they're poor, so their likelihood of becoming being formalized as a criminal goes up. And by virtue of being formalized as a criminal, they're poor, and most likely their kids are poor. And then their kids are more likely to be formalized as a criminal. And it just creates this nice little loop.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that sort of momentum that you talk about that with addiction and things too. Is how when people like that, experiment we were talking about with the rats who became addicts because they were in a shitty cage. So if you're a poor person who grows up in a shitty household where your parents are addicts and they are not taking care of you properly and you don't get the attention you want and you grow up with this deficit of attention and deficit of love and you want this stuff, you try to find it, you're way more likely to become an addict because you're going to try to find it through the heroin needle or whatever. The people who in Vancouver, and Vancouver's east side is very well known for being very addicted, very a community in a lot of pain. And the people who work with addicts, like this guy I mentioned, Gabor Mate, he'll say that like when he deals with this population that's really addicted to things like heroin, like he talks about he said like 100% of the women that he was dealing with who were addicted to heroin, 100% of them were abused as children. All of them. They were all like either sexually or physically abused somehow when they were young.
Yeah, but you could find similar stats when you just look at populations in general. Like depending on how you define abuse, you can find huge numbers of people who suffer some form of abuse. I mean, that's one of the things. I listen to a lot of Loveline, and every single caller, if you just keep asking questions, you can find abuse.
Sure, but I mean, it's levels of that abuse, though.
I'm sorry.
There's a difference, right?
Let me just say where I'm coming from. I'm kind of skeptical of Mr. Mate. He has some ideas and some concepts that he pushes that I just they just scream BS to me.
Do you know his work already? Like
I don't know his entire body of work, but of what I am familiar, there's parts of it that I'm skeptical of. Like there's
so
some
you've,
good
you've work. Heard about him other than just through me, because I don't want to be like your only representation of him, because I'm not going to explain his ideas.
No. He has a really interesting TED Talk.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is how I was sort of introduced to him and sort of his line of work. So I've looked into him otherwise.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I think his models are pretty right on, especially when it comes to addiction, because I can relate to a lot of how he puts things.
Well, the thing he did about the people who get in like terrible accidents, and they're on like the morphine drips. And
okay.
How many people, when they suddenly they leave the hospital and they go home, they're just not at they're just, they've been on morphine drip for 6 months and suddenly they don't need morphine anymore because they're
right.
home. And it's and he makes this whole point about environment, completely ignoring the fact that morphine dependence is like a massive problem. Like it's not a made up issue. Like there's tons of morphine addicts as a result of their morphine drips. So it's the same thing with Freud, who anytime someone's situation couldn't really match what he was talking about, it was because then that was a good enough environment for them. With Mate, it's like he has this sort of abstract concept that anyone who you know, they left the hospital and they're still addicted to morphine. Well, that's because that environment was too bad for them. It wasn't positive enough for when you take the rat and put it into the other cage. That the other cage you put them in wasn't clean enough.
Well, who knows? Like, but that's it becomes so. There's going to be so many other factors that come in. Like, who knows? Like. When they and I don't really know the statistics or anything about like who actually like how many people do get addicted to morphine after being in the hospital and how many don't. I don't know that specifically.
I'm picking on the one statement because that's the one that immediately comes to mind that bothered me.
Sure.
When I read that is anytime you attempt to attribute one cause to something that people do. People are incredibly complex,
right.
And there's no one cause.
Sure. And I think by saying just the environment, it's like, it's a simple way to get that point across, but I would assume he doesn't think of it as that simple either. Like it's pro, like the environment could be many different, like environment could just be like your spouse who you hate and you want to get out of this relationship. And so, but it's, you're too much of a pussy to break up with her or whatever. So you just turn to like escaping through like playing World of Warcraft instead of dealing, or like, or could be like whatever. It could be like you're in a shitty house right beside an airport and you hate living there and whatever. Like I like it, the environment can encompass so many different things. It's just kind of like a simple way of expressing that, like, it's the pain from your environment, whatever, however pain that, because I've heard that same thing come up with talking about soldiers, actually, soldiers who were at war in like Vietnam, and also I think in Afghanistan and Iraq, because there's a lot of opium in both of those areas, that soldiers would go over there and they would get addicted to opium or heroin or in some form, some kind of opiate while they were over there. And then when they got back, they would no longer be seeking that heroin anymore. And I've heard that. And it's along the same lines.
And I don't know the specific issue that you're referencing there. So my issue is that with what I have read from him is that there is a lot of language that, although maybe academically, if it was he presents things in a way as to assign a single cause. And even when you say, well, his single cause is entirely encompassing, when you say environment, no matter what you include into environment, attributing a human process to one cause is outside. It falls outside of science. Causality is impossible to establish in science with a human behavior or factor with one cause.
Well,
I just got real nerdy just, there. I read academic journals like, for fun, guys. I'm a nerd.
One cause, like I think you could say like one cause as like one word to represent the causes, but like just because it's a word or like a certain descriptive way to describe it, I don't think it means it's just one cause. I think you can say like pain, like you'll say pain is the cause of addiction. And pain may be one thing, but it encompasses all sorts of shit. Like it encompasses physical pain, like having an injury and getting depressed and then becoming addicted, or it encompasses like having emotional pain and lacking like love or something, or lacking attention and trying to find that through some way. I mean, you said you've been addicted as well, right? Like you find yourself sort of addicted to World of Warcraft.
Dude, I'm 350 pounds. Of course.
Are you really 350?
Damn. Yeah. Well, not good so much guy. Anymore. Closer to 300.
Okay. Well. Yeah, but I mean, so why did you get addicted? Why do you think it was that happened for you?
Oh, because. I'll say this. I have anxiety problems. I have depression problems, and this is getting edited because I sound like an idiot right now. I will say that eating copious amounts of food and playing obscene amounts of World of Warcraft was my way of coping with a complex biological and environmental collision that happened with me.
So, but you could summarize that by saying pain, right? Like you could say like anxiety, depression, etc. is a form of pain, and that's just like summarizing.
Even then, you're creating an entirely new
abstract concept of pain, associating it with, so it, like you're assigning new things to the term pain, in sort of piggybacking on the connotations of the word.
Well, it's just about creating meaning.
It's easier to just to say a single word when you're discussing it, I'm sure, than every single time saying the long combination of biological and environmental issues coming into connection.
I'm getting so far off the trail here, and I realize that. But I think some things should be hard to say and explain. The way someone feels when they have an encompassing level of stress because, you know, they hate their wife, or because grandpa molests them or whatever, shouldn't be that should be a hard, like, we sure. shouldn't have just words discussing on hand. These and I'm way off the beaten path, and I realize, like,
no, I mean, this is honestly the stuff I'm talking about, like, what the stuff that I'm doing with my project Change Truth. I'm talking about drugs, addiction, mental health, and this is the kind of thing, and they're not simple things to talk about, and they're not easy for people to talk about either. They're complicated.
I think just assigning the word pain, making a simple word that can, like, encompass all of it, sort of cheapens what that concept is, because it's not pain, it's different. Like, there's sure. there can be physical pain associated, but it's not the same thing, and it sort of cheapens it.
Sure. And that's just definitions of words, right? Like, how, if you see pain as a specific thing, then that word isn't going to work. But just we're limited by our words, by how we can describe things, and if we're trying to do things simply and make it so it's easy, like, there's a quote that someone, I forget who said this, but, like, it might have been, like, Einstein, I don't remember, but it was like, if you can't express something simply, then you don't fully understand it, or something like that. So I think by breaking things down to a simple level, it's just a way of trying to get a point across, and maybe it doesn't encompass the entire construct of the idea, but it's just like trying to get it through so that people can kind of relate to and understand. And when talking about, like, psychedelics helping in this way, it's very complex. It's very hard to get that point across because the words we have available are hard to use. Like, if I say, yeah, I mushrooms give me a spiritual connection. Well, people hear spiritual and they're going to go, get the fuck out of here, you fucking dirty hippie. I don't want to hear you talk about spiritual healing or plant medicine. Or, you know, there's, so to try to pick the Fox words is magic. Just tricky. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, even the word psychedelic, you know, people have connotations to, or certain things. So it becomes tricky with the subject, with picking the right words. It is tough.
Okay, I can go with that. Definitely go with that. We are coming up on 2 hours here. What are, Matthew? You've been quiet today. What's wrong?
Right? I know. Yeah, I don't know. I've just been listening.
You have no input? You don't like to contribute to your own show?
I'm here to learn, just like everybody else.
Well, okay.
So I want to ask you guys, actually, about your own... we've talked about, like, addiction a little bit, but what about, like, drug use? Because you've mentioned that we brought up marijuana, and it seems like, Rob, like, you're... don't seem like you're a marijuana user.
No, not at all.
Do either of you guys have much experience using drugs, whatever, like from coffee to alcohol to MDMA or whatever?
Oh, yeah. I've used
I hardly ever drink caffeine.
So we pretty much are on the opposite page there, I suppose.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't do any of that. He hardly drinks caffeine, apparently.
Wow.
I got the... real talk here, caffeine does not agree with my stomach.
Well.
Like, have you ever got, like, muscle spasms on your stomach?
Recently I had some weird stomach cramp type thing. I don't know if it was caffeine or what, but no, not usually. For me, I guess.
Yeah, it was all that semen you've been swallowing.
Okay. Well, you know, that'll cramp up anybody's belly every once.
Tell us about all the scorpion tails you smoke.
What?
Scorpion tails?
Yeah, that's a psychedelic. Scorpion tails.
Oh, I've never smoked scorpion tails. I didn't know that was a thing.
There's some phrase for it, like blowing tails or something.
No, that you're just bullshitting now. This is some fucking Family Guy shit or something.
It's like cat piss on South Park.
Right, yeah. Blowing tails.
Dude, you're going to make me look this up.
So, Matt, then, what have you used, Matt? I'm just curious.
Lots of drugs. I don't know. I used to smoke pretty heavily. I don't anymore.
Marijuana.
Yeah. Well, I smoke cigarettes now, but done mushrooms maybe a dozen times.
Okay.
LSD, MDMA, Molly, if there can be called a difference there. I don't know. Prescription pill. I mean, I've done my fair share of stuff, I suppose.
So you've done a lot of the psychedelics. So I'm curious, like, you've done mushrooms 12 times. Like, what is your experience with mushrooms? Do you find them to find any benefit out of it? Or do you take them to this, like, trip out or whatever?
No, I definitely think there could be benefits to them. And that I don't know that it was something – there's out of a dozen times, let's say, maybe – three or four of those have been, I would say, very beneficial. You know, I never really took them to be. What?
Well, we're batting 2,500 here. What were the other 75%?
Well, they were. I'm not saying they were negative by any means. They were good times. I just mean there was maybe three or four that were especially that when people refer to it as like something that changes how they are. Or how they think on a noticeable way as soon as they're, you know, done tripping or whatever for an extended amount of time. You know, a lot of them, I just take it and it was back to just whatever the next day or just regular life or whatever.
Gotcha.
So, by the way, there is a type of scorpion native to Afghanistan that if you smoke its tail, it's mescaline.
Oh, no way. Are you serious? Yeah, I've never heard about that.
The tail. Yeah. Wow. And people, I can't find the phrase I was looking for, but the people who sell them are called sting sellers.
Pretty badass.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, mescaline's a big one. It's mescaline peyote or San Pedro? Or are they both mescaline? Do you guys know?
I was gonna ask you actually. I'm not sure. You don't hear mescaline mentioned nearly as much as you hear of any of the rest of the psychedelics.
Yeah, I believe it's from one of the cactuses, the cacti, and they're used in South America as well. Actually, in Peru, where they use ayahuasca, the San Pedro cactus is very popular as well with the traditional ceremonial stuff.
Is this the stuff that you pour down your nose?
I don't think so. No, you're talking about like the stuff that you snort, like a powder stuff.
No, I've seen video of these people. It's like this fluid. And they literally pour it down their nose.
Like a neti pot?
Oh, my God.
What?
Like a neti pot?
I have no clue what that is.
Those things that you pour up your nose to clean out your sinuses.
Yeah, I've never seen one of those. But I guess, yeah, that's what you're describing. These people, yeah, they pour it on the nose because it's... Ugh.
I've never just put like anything on my nose.
Definitely.
Other than my finger, I've never put anything up there. So I don't know much about that.
Yeah, like, if you think of, like, I know I've had, like, some pretty gnarly boogers. like think about, like, how, like, thick and disgusting they are if, like, your finger could go, like, an eighth of an inch further up. It's a wasteland of, I mean, just the
you
stuff
think, you really? Your nose.
Dude, like your finger's only so long, and it's the same width for, I mean, unless you put on major weight for a while. Or lose
so there's
major
just
weight.
A gold mine in there is what you're saying.
I don't know if there's like a whole...
You have a whole nasal cavity.
Right, I don't think there's a lot of boogers there. Is it boogers, mucus meets air?
I think so. I feel like it has
so
to get
feel
to
like
the
deeper
near
you
the
go,
nose.
You
breathe in through your nose.
I think you'll just get to your brain if you go far enough. You'll just like poke yourself in the brain.
Yeah,
I don't think you'll get to boogers.
Sure there's a division between your nasal cavity and your brain called the skull.
well, there's holes in it.
Yeah, I think the brain is held in there somehow. You know.
Well, I guess that would make sense.
It just floats.
Yeah, it does float,
but it's in a.
Well, I mean, that's the whole reason people snort stuff is it's supposed to get to your brain quicker, no?
Right, the blood-brain barrier.
I actually had to remember this for a test. The fastest administration methods. It's ingestion, then snorting, then skin popping, then IV use, then
skin popping.
It's when you inject not into a vein.
Ew.
Mm.
Like instead of like mainlining, you go into just I'm just gonna shoot it right into my butt.
Just a muscle.
Yeah, muscle or a fat area.
Oh.
Right.
It's people who they want to do heroin or whatever, but they don't want to take the risk of like they don't want to be that hardcore. They don't want to mainline.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick a needle in me, but I'm not touching a vein.
No, like that's the logic behind it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Smoking was the quickest.
Smoking. Yeah, smoking is quick, yeah.
Anything you smoke crosses the blood-brain barrier faster than something you shoot up intravenously.
Hmm. Makes sense. Yes, that
makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they did do in Peru, like the place that I went to do the ayahuasca, they had after the ayahuasca was over, they had a second week, and a lot of people I was with stayed there for that, and they call it huachuma, which is the San Pedro cactus, and they do that, but they also do this other stuff. It's a form of DMT, which is what is in ayahuasca as well, but it's a different, it's like, I'm not familiar with the chemistry of it all. It's like 5-MeO DMT, and then you have like some other types of DMT. But they do this other DMT, and they snort it. They snort it, and they call it the Vilca. And they snort it through like a 2,000-year-old bone or something that they put up their nose. And it's supposed to simulate death. It's supposed to simulate dying. And people, when they do it, they report actually feel like literally floating out of their body, or like first they report like feeling like they can't breathe, like their breath becomes very shallow, becomes hard to breathe, and you feel like you're dying, your body's like achy and stuff, and you're like, oh my god, I'm dying, and then they report floating out of their body and looking down at their own body and having this out of body experience, but I didn't do that, so I can't actually say firsthand. I don't know.
People, do they make you do the ayahuasca first? Like, you couldn't just jump to week two?
No, you can jump to week two. You could, okay. Yeah. You could do that. But, like, out of, like, 25 people, it seemed like probably, like, 19 or so were staying. Like, a lot of them were staying for the second thing.
The full experience.
Yeah. It sounded really interesting and stuff, but it's really expensive to just go there and, I don't know.
There was the gold package for your spirit trip.
Yeah.
Get your first class ticket to enlightenment.
Yeah. And, exactly. That's why I think it's not like the model they're using for this. I don't think is the model that has to be used. I'm not trying to like promote shamanism to my community here in the Yukon or to Canada. I'm not trying to tell people they should go. I mean, if you're interested in that, it's a great way to do it. Like it was awesome there. It's a beautiful place. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's on right off like the Amazon River. It was amazing. The grounds they have there are great. And a lot of people get a lot out of it by doing it this way. But what I'm promoting is more sort of like the guy I talked to in Vancouver, my first podcast I did, he was a guy using Ibogaine to treat heroin addicts.
That's legal in Canada.
Yeah. And that's totally legal here in Canada. It's illegal in the States though, actually, hippies. but it's legal up here. And like Ibogaine is crazy. If you've heard about that, like that psychedelic trip will last like 36 hours.
Which is just way too much of a commitment.
It's pretty crazy. Like
I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow morning. Much less.
Well, I mean, he flew to Peru for this experience on the ayahuasca. I think if somebody's going to do that, they can.
he only got the silver package.
The funny thing is though, the Ibogaine in Vancouver is more expensive than the ayahuasca in Peru.
Really? Okay, yeah. Is it legal like
rich white
across the board there? Like you could just buy it. Would you have to go to one of these?
Six pack of Bud? No.
I think you can just order it. online probably if you wanted to get iboga or ibogaine. I haven't really looked into getting any myself, so I don't know that process, but I think it's available. You can just get it. I mean, it's legal. I'm sure you can just buy it.
See, I agree.
If you find the source.
I agree with you in terms of the shamanism not being the only way to do it. But being able to just, like he said, buy it with a six-pack of beer, there'd be so much problem with someone getting...
Well, first of all, only if people are uneducated and only if we don't have the structure set up. So what I want to do is like set up a structure like this guy who has a clinic where he's treating people... when he has a nurse on hand and he has morphine on hand. So when heroin addicts come in, he has a nurse administer them legal morphine so that they can wean off their heroin addiction slowly. Yeah, because when you're physically addicted to heroin, the withdrawals can be like just devastating. A tiny bit. You have to – like that's how they're treating heroin addiction is they're giving them like methadone, which is just another form of – it's another opiate, but it's like a slow drip. So instead of getting a quick shoot up of heroin, you're getting a slow drip so that you can manage your day without getting withdrawal symptoms.
Okay, we're getting into a real philosophical thing here about whether or not replacement therapy is actual treatment.
Right.
Sure.
I'm sorry?
I don't believe that just replacing the opiate with another form of opiate is much of a treatment. It's like a temporary fix, you know, but it's not.
Like we see it's they're not very successful.
Right. It doesn't work.
I know we have a good friend who I believe it was successful for, right, Matt?
Sure we do.
We've had him on the show before, Vern.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It was fairly successful for him, but in general, replacement therapies aren't very successful. I mean, how many Suboxone addicts?
And the reason I think that's not successful is because the addiction is just a symptom. The addiction itself is not the cause. It's not the root cause. In order to cure the addiction, because I believe with what Gabor Mate says is that it's pain that causes the addiction. I think to cure the addiction, you need to cure the pain. And that's where these psychedelics come in, is they can help you get to that root cause of what's fucking with you. What is it that's fucking with you? And you can analyze it and figure out a sort of a route to go in from that point on to say, oh, like this is fucking with me. I need to work on this so that won't fuck with me anymore. And then you do the work and then you work toward not being addicted anymore because you work toward healing your own pain. And the psychedelics, I'm not promoting them as like something that's like a cure-all, like you just take it and you're cured. It's like a psychedelic. The power of them is to show you the work you need to do to help heal yourself. It's not going to heal you just by taking whatever it is.
Awesome. And with that, our guest has been Carl Christensen of the Change Truth podcast. You can find him on changetruth.com, right?
.com? That's right, yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. This has been really fun. You guys have a good podcast here.
No, thanks.
Appreciate it. You Facebook or anything that people find you on?
All my social media stuff is I'm on Twitter and whatnot, but just go to changetruth.com and it's all linked through there. So.
Well, tell us about the name. Like what's the genesis of the name Change Truth?
That Change Truth is I'm trying to change people's minds. You know, I think people have their minds made up on a lot of these subjects like drugs. They think drugs are bad and that's all there is to it. And I'm trying to change their minds. And that's why I called it Change Truth. I'm trying to change the truth, change what people believe to be the truth about these things.
Right on. So Carl Christensen has been our guest. Thank you all for listening.
Your head, grab a beer, go online, rock with me instead.